Ian Berry, Magnum photographer. Welcome to Cardiff.
Thanks very much.
Great to see you again. And I'm going to start this with the now, really, because I was listening to an interview quite recently, and you mentioned the beauty of Salgado and the fact that he was so good at finding a theme, you know, and then traveling all over the world to do that theme. And I've just wondered if you're working on any theme at the moment.
Well, I am, but sadly for me, I'm not as smart as Salgado. He's the one, you know, ultimate professional. Not only is he a great photographer, he's a guy who can go out and convince corporations, magazines, to upfront money for him to go off and do his thing. And he happens to be a nice guy, which is a very rare combination amongst photojournalists, believe me. But yeah, I'm working on a couple of things, but I don't get the money up front. I have to finance it myself because I'm not smart.
No, but you seem to like that freedom of the long project. Would you say that?
Yeah, well, it's good to have things going that you can do on your own in between assignments, because assignments these days are fewer and, you know, further apart than they used to be. I mean, you know, there was a time that we thought would never end, as they say. And I'm afraid, well, two things. One, the lack of magazines. And two, I'm not 21 anymore. And most of the people giving out assignments are picture editors or young ladies of about 30 of a certain age. And they're not looking for old farts like me. So, you know.
So, well, let's go back to that time then when you were coming up to that age. There must have been that sense of freedom that you had because you emigrated to South Africa.
Yeah.
Why South Africa for a start?
Well, it was pretty easy, actually, because, well, for several reasons. I wanted to travel. And in those days, long before your time, any of your time, you could get supported passages to New Zealand, Australia. I'm not sure about Canada, but South Africa. And I thought, great, let's go somewhere where someone's going to pay me part of the fee to go. And also, you know, New Zealand, Australia, I've been back since, and I wouldn't make the same decision today, obviously. But it just seemed a long way away. South Africa wasn't that far. Canada was a bit near to America. And I thought there'd be lions on the streets of Jobo, you know. I mean, it just seemed the most exciting. And actually, there was another thing that each of these countries, you could go without having any money as long as you had someone to guarantee you for a year. And it so happened that my family knew a South African, a photographer, in fact.
Are you talking to Roger Madden?
Yeah, who, you know, acted as my guarantor for a year. And I was really lucky because he was way ahead of anything going on here in the sense that it was more influenced by American photography. And although he wasn't actually doing, he was doing commercial work, but I had a great chance to learn lighting, printing. He was using, you know, multi-grade Varigam paper. I came back to England years later. They still weren't using multi-grade paper.
Yeah. But that sort of collaboration with Roger, when I first saw that, I thought, that's a strange one because, you know, Roger was an assistant to Ansel Adams. And when you look at your work over the years, obviously you did, maybe you didn't know then what you would be doing, but it's poles apart.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the time I spent with him, and he was terrific. And I think I probably learned in that year as much as you would learn going to a photographic school these days in I don't know how many years. Because it was compressed, I was doing it every day, I was doing all the work. I even learned how to make a good cup of tea, you know, it was okay.
Yeah. So was it the reason that you went to South Africa then? that you picked up a camera because of what you were going to see Roger, and he was sort of sponsoring that trip, or were you interested in photography before you went?
Yeah, it was actually. I was very lucky in that, I guess when I was about 16, my father, because I was interested, bought me a decent camera. I didn't want to get involved in my father's business. And this was a, you know, I wanted to be a journalist. But, you know, the truth is, my only qualification for being a journalist was I could make a good cup of tea. I mean, I can't write my own name, you know. So the switch over to photography was very easy for
me. Yeah. But those first few years then, you went into journalism because you were working for newspapers. I mean, with your personality, if you like, and that sense of freedom, did you find that quite confined?
Well, I was still a youngster, and I got myself a job with the Joburg Sunday Times Group. They had three newspapers, Sunday Times, the Express, and the Mail. And I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, we worked shifts. I worked 7 days a week if I could, because it was cheaper to eat in the canteen than anywhere else. But it was newspaper photography, and it did involve the things I was trying to avoid a little bit in journalism, which was, you know, going out 3 nights a week or 3 days a week to photograph the local mayor or whatever, doing a handshake, you know, and the art gallery openings, the, you know, all that stuff that you do. It was okay. I mean, when I joined, they gave me a speed graphic. I mean, I was already using 35 millimeter, and I thought, this is pretty amazing. But, you know, if you are going to go out in the evening and do a art exhibition opening, you go with a double dark slide and you line them up against the wall, you go bang, shoot another picture as a backup and go back, and, you know, in 3 minutes you can have a print for the magazine. So from that point of view, it was quite useful.
And it was a perfect education. If you were coming from Roger then into journalism, yeah, it was your deadlines and that type of thing must have been
because
important.
I'd already used 4x5 with Roger Madden. So, but I think within the year that I was there, by the end of the year, everybody was shooting 35. Not just because of me, but because it took actually much longer to process. You know, you couldn't process 35 millimeter film in a couple of minutes and not have ping pong balls on your image, you know.
Yeah, but then along came Drum magazine.
Yeah,
and,
well,
Sir Tom Hopkinson, who I was very lucky enough to meet at Newport when he came down, and found him the most wonderful gentleman. I don't know what he was like to work for, but obviously that was a big stepping stone for you to be on a magazine like that.
Yeah, I mean, he was brilliant. I mean, I knew about him, you know, when I worked on the Sunday Times. And when I heard he was coming down to edit this magazine Drum, and a magazine for Africans, I thought, here was a great opportunity to learn something about magazine photography, you know, as opposed to newspaper photography. And I went along and pestered him when he arrived until he gave me a job. And it was a pretty good experience. I mean, you know, I even went on stories with him, and, you know, Congo was all happening then. We went up to the Congo together and things like that, because Drum had a couple of West African editions, one in Nairobi and one in Nigeria, in Lagos. So that really got me moving.
Was that a steep learning curve, because you've come from that very rigid newspaper into quite a more looser, if you like, documentary style magazine? I mean, did you feel that you fitted in there? Was this when you found, this is what I want to do?
Well, I did, and I think Tom, I probably misled him a bit in that he assumed that I knew a bit about the business. And I would sit in on the, I mean, you know, he had a load of reporters there, African reporters, who, you know, some of them were school teachers, some of them were I mean, Peter Magavani, drum photographer, was actually a tough guy in the townships. And Tom would, give them instructions on how to do things and so on, because they were learning. And, of course, I listened in and learned at the same time. So it was pretty good period for me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't talk to you without mentioning Sharpeville. I mean, I know every time you give an interview, you must talk about it. But the one thing about Sharpeville that I found interesting, which I read on your website, I read on everything I read about you, is about you are the only photographer. And I'm thinking, well, this is a massive event and you're the only photographer. It's not very often I've seen why you were the only photographer there.
Well, it was very simple, really. It was my day off, and there was a strike by the PAC. They were the rival political party to the ANC, Pan-African Congress, rival to the African National Congress. They finally faded away, but they'd called a strike that day. But we didn't feel that there was that much going to happen. Anyway, mid-morning, Tom called me and said, look, a guy's been shot at this place called Sharpeville, which neither of us had ever heard of. Would you go out and have a look? And all the other reporters were out, all the drums' cars were out, and Tom lent me his car, and I went out with the news editor, a guy called Humphrey Tyler. When we got to Sharpeville, nothing was going on. There were a load of photographers hanging about outside. A lot of foreign press, cameramen, photographers. And we figured, well, this is probably nothing going to happen. But more or less, as we decided to leave, a load of, I don't really call them, APCs turned up, stuffed with police. The police were sort of quasi-military. And they headed into the township. Well, we all piled into our cars, there were about a dozen of us, and followed in. We'd only gone a couple of hundred yards when the officer in charge of the police came back and said, look, whites aren't allowed in an African township without a permit. I know you don't have any, none of you have a permit. Shove off, So most of them left. There were three cars that was carried on. And the other two were also local press, because we had a better understanding of how things work. But and we'd gone a little bit further into the township, and the officer came back again and said, look, final warning, you're arrested if you don't clear off. So the other two cars left, and Humphrey and I tossed up, decided that we'd follow at a decent distance, which we did. We got to the police compound, which was surrounded by, 10-foot wire. And Humphrey went and parked around the back of the police station out of sight. So I just wandered around and talked to guys, and, they weren't aggressive, and they certainly weren't anti-me. I mean, one of the pluses in Africa was that if you were a bit weedy looking and, your hair was a bit longer than the average front row forward, the Africans tended to think you're probably a foreigner and on their side. So I had no trouble at all. In fact, I kind of figured there wasn't anything going to happen, because they were shouting a bit, but usual stuff. And so I walked back to the car. And I was just going to say to Humphrey, you might as well shove off, because I'm the only white face in the crowd and I'm going to get arrested, when the shooting started. So that was it, really. There were no pictures. I had two Leicas with a 35 and a 50. I ran out of film on the 50 almost immediately. And so I was shooting with a wide angle as these guys were running towards me. At first I thought, they were shooting in the air. But it became apparent as people started to fall around me that they weren't. And that was it, really. It was the only good thing to come out of it was that, 76 dead and...
I think it was 69 people, I think it was.
Something like that, yeah. And about 140 wounded. Mm. and the wounded were nearly all shot in the back. And when it came to court, the police claimed to have fired in one burst, and I had photographs of them reloading. They said they'd fired from the ground, and I had them standing up on the APC shooting down onto the crowd. The first burst stopped, and I thought, that's it, and I was about to get up when they started shooting again. And when it stopped, I was the only person left standing. Mm. Everyone else had gone. And so, you know, I said to Humphrey, you know, we better get out of here swiftly because, I mean, the police only half jokingly had offered to shoot us before. You know, they hated Brits with a passion. And, you know, as an obvious Brit, I had to tread lightly with them. So that was it, really. The only thing is that the court case, because I was white, they believed me. The judge believed me, and all the wounded were acquitted. So that made it worthwhile being there.
Absolutely, we interviewed a Welsh photographer quite recently, Roger Tiley, who's photographed the mining industry and the demise of in the Welsh Valleys. He's a very much a political animal with his photography. And he told us that he became known as a photographer that was on the miners' side. Now, obviously, after your photographs being used in court, and especially that being successful, I mean, you're saying that you weren't flavour of the month anyway, but that did that make it worse afterwards?
Not really, because curiously, the police force was 90% Afrikaner, and they were not that well informed, you know, to be honest. I left South Africa not long after that. I kind of fell out with Drum. It's a boring, not with Tom, because Tom left as well. Mm. We both got fed up with the guy that owned it. And it was really difficult to cover Africa in those days from Joburg because you couldn't actually go anywhere except Nairobi. Because you couldn't get a visa for anywhere in West Africa or Central Africa, North Africa, from Johannesburg. So, in fact, if you wanted to go to the Ivory Coast, you had to fly to London, get the visa, come back. It wasn't very practical, you know.
Okay. Well, keeping on that sort of that big news story, this year is the 50th anniversary of the Abba Band disaster, which you were there. I mean, first of all, I'd like to know how you became part of that, because when did you hear about it? And was it something that when you did hear about it, you thought, I have to go?
I came back to live in England, or in Britain, if you like, because a Welsh friend of mine was the picture editor on the Observer, on the newspaper. And the Observer were just starting up a magazine, and they wanted a photographer who knew something about shooting colour. And, of course, nobody in Britain in those days was shooting colour, but we were in Paris. I had a couple of years in Paris. And he suggested, you know, that I sort of contact the Observer. So I had contacts through the Observer. We heard about Abba Van. And I went straight out there to have a look. And it was night when I got there, so I just stayed until dawn shooting. And that was about it from the immediate point of view. And then left, you know. And I think David also showed up. David Hearn.
Yes.
But it was not easy to shoot because it was pretty dark. I mean, they'd erected a few lights, so you were kind of limited, and you didn't want to shoot flash, frankly. You know, I can't say speak for everybody, but I felt a bit of an intruder. It was a pretty rotten scene, and a lot of people were, you know, really upset, obviously. So I just, you know, shot quietly by the light as well as I could. And that was it, really.
Mm. So sort of moving on, one of your books is about the English, one of your first books. And I'm just wondering from that how different it is to work now on the street compared to that time. And I'm just wondering, I know you've been asked this before, but I'm just wondering, would you like to redo that book now? How much more difficult would it be?
Hey, it's chalk and cheese, frankly. I have sympathy with any young photographers now who, you really had access in those days. I mean, you could go into a school and take pictures. You know, you'd go in, talk to the headmaster, mistress, and they would let you in. I can't remember ever being refused. I went round. I had a grant from the Arts Council, the first one a photographer got, which is what set me off shooting. And I also had an assignment from the Whitechapel Art Gallery. They wanted to have an exhibition of photographs, the first one they had, because, you know, showing paintings and sculpture, whatever the art gallery did, didn't bring in the local people in Whitechapel. And they wanted to bring in local people. So, you know, I was able to go around with Meals on Wheels, go into somebody's house. Nobody cared. I mean, I went into the London Hospital across the way in Whitechapel, and I went in to see the guy running it. I can't remember what you call a chief guy in a hospital, but whoever he was. And I went into his office and said, "Do you mind if I shoot a bit?" And he kind of looked at me sideways and sort of said, "Well, I can't give you permission without going higher up, but there's a white coat there with a stethoscope in the pocket. If you want to borrow it, go ahead. But, you know, if anyone stops you, I don't know you, you know." And nobody bothered me. You know, I wandered around and I shot. Well, a few years ago, there was a NHS had a big nursing anniversary, and I tried to think of an angle to go back and shoot in the same hospital. And I finally had a thought that, you know, there's an Anglican priest, a Catholic, a mullah, you name it, a Buddhist guy. I thought if I went round with each of them, that would give me access. And the hospital finally said yes, but I had to get permission from everybody before I took a photograph. You know, you can't work like that.
No.
I went round with a rabbi and with an Anglican, and as soon as people know you're there and, you know, they're smartening up and looking at you all the time, and forget it, really. And it even on the street now, you know, you're shooting in front of you, there might be a building there that you hadn't even noticed, and a guy will come out and say, "You can't do this on the street." And people stop you on the street and say, "You can't photograph me without my permission." Well, it's not true, of course, because you can still happily in Britain photograph people on the street without asking them. But things are changing. Mm. I mean, I had a workshop in Hungary, in Budapest last year, and just before I went, the government passed a law that you couldn't photograph anyone on the street without their written permission. And that was just before I went, and I sort of asked, is it still worth running this workshop? Because normally I send people out to shoot and then, you know, criticize it a little bit or try and help them with it. However, happily, all the Hungarian photographers said, "Forget it, you know, we don't have to worry." And they went out and shot as usual, so yeah. I don't know what's...
I mean, do you think that will happen here? Can you see that happening? Because I can see it moving closer and closer to that day, unfortunately.
Well, you know, and it's a bit that way in France now. In Paris, you get a lot of people stopping you if they see you shooting. A lot of people don't, but... it's changing rapidly, and you can't use a photograph of anybody in the newspaper without or in a magazine without getting their permission, you know.
Mm.
And you know what it is. You walk around for the day. You shoot 100 pictures. You can't ask everybody, you know, for permission, because how do you know, you know, you've got anything worthwhile you'll use anyway? So yeah, it's going a bit that way.
Yeah, I went to see a lecture with Steve McCurry when he was at the Hay Festival, and somebody got up and asked him, have you got permission for everybody you've taken pictures of? And of course, he was taking pictures of riots. And he got quite angry by the question, because obviously it's a ridiculous thing to even think about doing that. But sort of looking at the body of work that you've done, I mean, I don't think there's a country in the world that probably you haven't stepped on at some stage. But you seem to be attracted to Africa more than anywhere. Is that because of the first visits? And
actually, I have to say it's now the contrary. I'm steering clear mostly of Africa.
Are you?
I got hooked up by a Chinese magazine, and they've hired me now for half a dozen trips. And I love shooting there. I mean, people don't mind. I mean, they've all got their phone anyway. Whereas it's got, South Africa, the last time I went down, I actually went up north to do something on the farmers there. The top of South Africa, as you know, borders on Zimbabwe. And the farmers are getting killed. They walk around with a gun all the time. I stayed with a farmer, and his house was completely surrounded with razor wire. And at dusk, he'd walk around with his shotgun and fire a few shots in the air just to let people know. And in the house, apart from the iron gates on all the doors and the wind and the ironwork on the windows, an iron gate in the house by the bedroom. And they had walkie-talkies there, not to talk to the police, but to talk to other farmers. Because if they had a problem, they wouldn't call the police, they would call, you know, call the other farmers. And in Joburg, where I used to live in Hillbrow, which was when I was living there, was a kind of a good area to be. It was where air hostesses and journalists and so on lived. It was a good place. Now it's full of kids sniffing glue. And the Sunday Times lent me a desk. And I was talking to the journalists, and I said, I'm going to go shoot in Hillbrow. And they said, no way, you must be crazy. But I wanted to do this. And I hired a guy with a gun to walk behind me. And I needed him. He stopped me being mugged twice in the first morning. You know, he just spotted what was happening, and he'd just come up behind me and show his gun. And
but did you get the pictures?
They were clear off. Yeah, I got some pictures. Yeah, but that's only happened to me. The only other time in my life is in Naples, and I had a cop to walk behind me. I was doing a story on the Camorra, but it's more dodgy in Hillbrow than in Naples.
But what attracts you to a story? I mean, other than people asking you to do something, which obviously is quite attractive when they're paying, but what actually attracts you? I mean, are you a political animal, or is it more a social thing, or is it just what interests you at the time?
Yeah, I'm not a political animal, I'm afraid. It's mostly the social scene that that grabs me. And, you know, I'm still an old-fashioned guy who tries to go on shoots with an open mind. You know, I don't go there trying to prove something, because you often find, you know, when you get there that what you thought is, I mean, like the Afrikaans farmers, I don't have any great love of the Afrikaners, but, you know, you've got to have sympathy for them living like that. And I went to one farm which was owned by an old woman who was in her late 70s, and her grandfather was buried on the farm, and the government had just appropriated it and said some guy working for her had claimed that it was his, and she was being booted out. Well, you know, you've got to have some sympathy. And, you know, they treated me very well. partially because they thought I was French. sometimes you... I had a friend in South Africa, a journalist, and before I went, I had an assignment from Parry Match. I said, I'm coming down for Match to do this story on the farmers. Would you mind contacting the Farmers Union in Pretoria and seeing if they will put me in touch with somebody? And when I got there, they kind of assumed that I was French, and I didn't disillusion them. And I stayed with a farmer who was terrific. He was really kind. He put me up, let me shoot, followed him around. I was complimented on my English. my only worry was the farmer said he had a French guy who lived nearby that he wanted to introduce me to, and I was scared stiff that this guy would turn up. He'd spot in about 2 seconds that my schoolboy French was didn't exactly make me a Parisienne, you know.
No, but on that French theme, you were invited into Magnum by one of the greatest French photographers, not necessarily French, but with Henri Cartier-Bresson. And you've been a part of Magnum now from what I would call its heyday. And I'm not saying that Magnum is still not a fantastic agency, but it's different because so many people are taking pictures now than through the 60s, 70s, even 80s, and it's changed so much. You've obviously seen a massive change.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I learnt to my horror about a week ago, or about 10 days ago, in fact. We've got a new CEO who we're hoping is going to really revitalize Magnum. And during the course of the meeting with the photographers, he reminded me that I'm now the oldest member. as I joined as the youngest, it was a bit of a shock because I thought, about several other photographers, Elliot Erwitt and people who are still around, but they've become contributors. So I'm actually the only, I'm the oldest actual full member. But it's changed enormously. I'm hopeful that this guy is going to really rejuvenate us. He's a guy who's been with the BBC and been with Reuters, and he's interested in photojournalism, and he's also interested in getting us back on the editorial path and trying to find ways for us to get assignments on the web, to get backing for people to send us out to shoot in the same way that magazines used to. So we're kind of really hoping that this is going to be the way that we go in the future. Mm. But having said that, you're right. The photographers have changed too. And I understand it because it's really tricky for a young photographer. 20 years ago, if I wanted to go to Africa, the bureau chief would call Parry Match and say, look, he wants to go and do this. And they'd say, well, we're not really interested, but, we'll give him a couple of $1,000 to have first look. Well, these days you call them and they say, great, we'll have to see it when he comes back. But they're not going to back you,
Talking on that sort of social media side, Magnum now has 950,000 followers on Instagram. And a Magnum photographer, Matt Black, was awarded the Time Magazine Instagram Photographer of the Year. It's such a different... And I'm just wondering, have you ever thought about getting your iPhone out and...
I don't know how to take a picture with it. It's in my pocket, and I can make a phone call, and that's about it. I don't use it. I've never looked at Instagram. But when Matt applied to join, he showed his stuff, and a lot of it was shot on his iPhone. He was in, in Iraq somewhere in the Middle East, and he had his camera smashed. And rather than come back and get another camera, he went on shooting with his iPhone. And his pictures were terrific. He just has a great eye. And at the end of the day, that's what counts. Doesn't matter what you use. You know, I mean, Joseph Kodelka has for the last few years has been shooting panoramics. And they're a great shape. I mean, if you gave him a camera that shot in triangles, he'd make a shape in that triangle. You know, I mean, it depends on the eye. The problem is that now that a lot of photographers are trying to come into Magnum to use the name to further their art scene. And I understand it because they're not going to make a living as photojournalists, except for people like Matt Black, who really have a great eye. And we have a few guys now, mostly in Paris and New York. We're desperate to find people in Britain. But they have to go out at their own expense and, you know, risk their lives in Syria or wherever. If they're good enough, and usually they're good enough, it works. But you can't get a magazine. You know, if you look at the Sunday supplements in this country these days.
Yeah, but it's not only that. It's you're up against other agencies. You're up against AFP. You're up against Reuters. Against all these other agencies.
Sure.
So the single photographer can't afford to be going out with dishes hanging out of their windows, etc.
And there are good Syrian photographers these days, and, you know, wherever.
Mm.
You know, I'm working in China a lot now, and I'm going there at the beginning of next month. A plug for me. I'm having an exhibition and giving a workshop, and I know that one of the radio programs there or television program has sent me a thing to answer questionnaire. You know, why doesn't Magnum have any young Chinese photographers? Basically, we don't have an official Chinese photographer there, and it's a problem because the Chinese, who are kind of very smart. I mean, I went last year to judge the Singapore Magazine Photographer of the Year, and it was an enormous prize. I think something like £10,000 equivalent. And there were a couple of great photographers, but they're, you know, if they don't speak English, they're sort of nervous about getting into another environment. And, you know, Magnum photographers have got to travel. You can't just shoot in your own country. Mm. It's tricky. And unfortunately, the people that come to us are very much influenced by the art world. In a way, they've already gone past photojournalism, if you like, and they want to make a living selling prints.
Yeah. But never mind the Chinese. What about the Welsh? I mean, what advice would you give to any sort of photographer now in college, in university, like our friend here? That
anyone who's good enough will make it. You know, I mean, it's a bad transition period from magazines to the web, but it will happen, I think. I mean, I'm being optimistic, you know. And whatever you do, you're going to have to finance yourself somewhere apart from shooting, hoping to do photojournalism. I mean, even when I was doing it, you know, I've got two ex-wives. I had two kids that I had to fund in, you know, in boarding school because my wives were both journalists. Someone had to, you know, and I did a lot of corporate work, which even then, the day rates were about four times editorial rates. So I think, you know, you've got to be honest with yourself. And I had a call this morning from a lass who lives in Preston, and I happen to have been born in Preston. She heard about it, and she called me. The same question, what do I do? And the only thing is to prepare a great portfolio of what you want to do. You know, it's no good going to Magnum or the other agencies with a portfolio of wedding photographs, even though you're making a living shooting wedding photographs, because it's a way to do it, and why not? But it's the ideas now. You've got to come up with an idea, and you can shoot a great story in Wales. I mean, I'm going to have a look at Aberfan tomorrow on my way home. It's the anniversary. I'm not saying that's something you could do today, but you could. You know, I mean, you'd have much better access than I would into the school, you know, in Aberfan. But, you know, if you think of Eugene Smith, a country doctor, Schweitzer, Minimata, all kind of local stories, maybe in different parts of the world, but local stories, which if you really develop, everybody's going to use, you know. And you have access locally, which, you know, a stranger like me coming in wouldn't have that access. Not immediately, anyway. You'd have to spend a lot of time, you know, beforehand.
But regardless, the cream will come to the top.
Who knows? You know, nobody's heard of Magnum, for God's sake. You know, you're much better off if you can go along and say, you know, you work for the Merthyr Tydfil Express than you would saying, you know, you're from Magnum. But this is why, mostly, I like my friends in China to give me a call and say, we want you to do a story on this city, and we'll, you know, give you an interpreter, and you can go and spend a couple of weeks running around. The interpreter gets me access because it's for a Chinese magazine. It means I can get into factories, I can get into schools, stuff that I couldn't do here, which you can still do there. So, you know, I love doing that. It might be an easy option, but, you know, talking about the English, a publisher approached me a couple of years ago and said, would you like to redo it? And I kind of thought about it, and in a way I would, but I'm not sure this time in my life that I have the time. And it's, you know, I've got a couple of other projects. One other project I've been working on for about 10 years. And I'm doing a lot in China. And, you know, I'm having this exhibition there, which encourages the people who are bringing me there. And I just enjoy shooting.
It's still a fantastic way to earn a living, isn't it?
It's better than working, for God's sake. You know, it really is. I've never worked a day in my life, you know. It's just fun.